This might be, there's one question I wanted to ask you, Alan. This might be an opportune time, but so, see, wrote it down here. So synchronicity, yeah, ultimately is a manifestation of an unseen underlying connectedness of all things. So like, to use Plato's cave analogy, where, you know, we're inside of a cave and we see there's a bird flying outside, which we don't see, but we see the shadow on the inside. And perhaps, you know, one analogy is that the synchronicities are the shadow that we find. What do you think corresponds to the bird? Like, what is this metaphysical architecture, if that's even an accurate way to put it, that gives rise to what we experience as synchronicities?
Great question. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think this kind of speaks to what David's point before, is that you can have a map of something, but if it doesn't, you'll never be able to show, you asked about the tree of life, and he's trying to explain it, and I gave the example of that, trying to get it as a model of, say, the solar system. Well, of course, not only is that map in movement, but there exists something beyond the solar system, right? And if you were to look at the tree of life, this is something that Dave and I have discussed many times, is the idea that it's stressed that even the top of that tree is not what we might call God or the all or anything like that. It's still only an emanation from that. So in the sense of, yeah, that tree might be a map of the solar system, but there's still this whole other universe beyond it. In much the same respect, I think it's a sort of fool's errand to say, we're definitely looking at signifier versus signified. How to put that signified into words or something you can wrap your mind around is something that I don't really expect to be able to do. I don't mean that as a cop-out. I mean that as like a very real answer. I know we're able to point. We're able to point to something and say, like, see, this is letting us know something's there. Again, if that's an aspect of ourselves, you know, we've talked about synchronicity as a mirror, that it allows us to view aspects of ourselves, I think is, again, one of the most practical uses of it, if not spiritually profound. It's also very practically significant in a sort of Jungian sense of use your synchronicities to figure out what are your, you know, mental hang-ups and different things that you need to cope with within yourself. What are the things that you're either suppressing or need to address? I think that's really practical. But I think the spiritual significance, if you want to call it that, is also really profound, that telling us, you know, whether or not it's all one, we're not alone. That there are other forces at play. Those don't necessarily have to be benevolent forces or malevolent forces. You know, these can be simply forces of nature. It could be the coding of the matrix. You know, like, how do you want to, it's almost like watching a movie. How do you want to interpret it? It's like to say, what does it mean? I don't know. I just don't even know how to, if it's possible. You know, David said this earlier, this idea of if you can actually pronounce the name of God, then you know, that's basically it.
That's dissolution, too.
Yeah. I remember being a small child, and I had this thought that it stayed with me, and I don't know where I got it from. It was just like one of those things that I had this thought that if you could ever figure out the meaning of life, that would be the moment of your death. Like, even when you see someone gets hit by a car and you go like, oh, you know, how did that, whatever. How do you not know that that person was walking down the street, had a flash of inspiration, realized what it was, and then boom, their time here was gone.
Right. That's what happened to JFK when he realized the answer to the universe and everything and his head blew up.
Exactly. So this was just an idea I had as a kid. But, you know, in that respect, when you're talking about Dave Bowman in that room, in the Renaissance room, it would almost seem to be that, right, his enlightenment coincides with the moment of his death and rebirth. It's that same sort of idea. And it's almost like if you could actually put it into words, or if you could actually vocalize it, conceptualize it, anything, you would have to be it, or something along those lines. I had a very similar kind of thought as a younger adult, probably in my early 20s, very, very similar idea. And I'll admit this idea was during a psychedelic experience that I was trying to explain something to somebody, and they were trying to explain something to me, these like really heady concept of like this realization of the universe and whatever, you know? And I don't know if anyone's either of you ever had that experience where you're trying to convey this, you know, psychedelic mystical insight in the moment and it doesn't work. And I had this thought that if every one of us has a secret truth that we don't know how to convey, and if you could ever get someone to fully understand you, this, like, I pictured in my mind these two sort of like droplets of oil or mercury sitting on a table, you know? And if you could ever get the other person to fully understand it, it was like, you know, the two puddles joined together and then that's it. Of course, this takes us to alchemy and all that sorts of stuff, but it's just the idea of I've reached a point where I certainly don't think I've figured out what the bird is, and I'm very open to what the bird is for everyone else.
Bird is the word.
I don't know. So this is, again, this is not to dance around the answer. It's to say that this is how I think when I ask myself that same question. These are the thoughts and the sort of circles that my mind runs in.
Right. I mean, what about like the notion of a soul or the afterlife or reincarnation, or say, you know, some people speak of other densities. You know, maybe there might be kind of a landscape, a metaphysical landscape that one can still kind of walk around and explore without going straight up to the Godhead. You know, is there more of a structure here? Even if it's just, I understand it would just be speculation, but if there's some kind of ideas that you resonate with along these lines.
Absolutely. I definitely think there are, you know, for lack of a better term, astral realms, which again is not necessarily like the same thing as a, you know, a Godhead. There are spiritual dimensions and these kind of astral dimensions. I've experienced things that let me know there is reality to these concepts. You know, for whatever it's worth, I'm not going to rehash everything here, but you know, my experiences with the star Sirius, before even knowing what a loaded thing that was, that other people have had these experiences and all the sort of mystical traditions that are around this star, like, just, I can't deny that things have happened, that I've had either straight up premonitions of things or, you know, a kind of experienced brief moments of telepathy. I've discussed in the show before, you know, I had this week-long experience where I kept having these dreams. I felt like I was getting this contact from the star Sirius. And it was just a dream, and I kind of just chalked it up to a dream, but it kept repeating, and I finally said, all right, like, if this is real, if you're trying to show me something, show it to me. And the next day, I'm in the store, standing in front of the lottery machine. I wasn't about to play Lotto. I actually never played Lotto. It was funny, because I had these friends who were like regular Lotto players, and I was always like, you suckers, just throwing your money away, why the fuck are you doing that, you know, like, whatever. And then of course I'm standing in front of this Lotto machine, and just these numbers pop into my head so clearly, and I said, okay, screw it, let me play. And I play, and I won $2,500. Wow. Now so a number of things that come from this, I mean, the numbers that popped in my head were very significant numbers. It's also that it came directly after asking this thing, okay, if you have some sort of ability to show me something, prove it. I felt like it kind of proved it. But then there's the fact that the next day, there was this woman who I had had these, I can only explain as telepathic experiences, meaning like she she was from Africa. She was like this elderly woman. I worked in a medical I worked as a pharmacy technician, and there was this woman who lived in the, this was in Manhattan, she lived in the projects in Harlem, like right across the street from where I worked, and she was this like old woman who had this leg injury. She couldn't get out of the house, and I would sometimes go and bring her medicine, and we would just sit and talk about like all the weirdest shit you could imagine, right? And she would occasionally, her phone would ring, and then she would speak in her native tongue, and I don't remember, I want to say like Ugandan or something. I honestly don't recall what the native tongue was, but it was something like that, a language that I obviously don't speak. And so I have this experience, whatever, and like one, so I've heard her speak it, but no idea what it was. And then one night I'm falling asleep, and I start to hear this woman's voice in my mind. And at first she's speaking in her native tongue, and then suddenly I'm able to understand it. And I'm just, it's not that she was speaking in English.
Right.
It wasn't like I was translating it. She was speaking, but I understood it. If that, do you get what I mean? It's like I suddenly knew another language. And it was only after a few minutes that I paused and said, what the hell, like, how am I doing this, that it stopped and it didn't make sense anymore. It was at the moment I questioned it that it stopped making sense.
Oh, you went from the right brain to the left brain.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I went and I saw the woman the next day, and now, bear in mind, I didn't say a single word to this woman about the lottery thing. I go to her, and she says, she points to the TV, like, while we were just standing there, and she had the TV on, and, like, the lottery numbers come up on the screen, and she goes, she just looks at me and she goes, you know, I knew what those lottery numbers were going to be. And I said, oh, yeah? And she goes, I had a vision. I knew what the numbers were going to be. And I said, did you play? And she goes, no, I didn't play. Why would I play? Like, what does that prove? And it was almost like a sort of like, yeah, big deal. So you figure out the lottery numbers. But bear in mind, I never mentioned to her that this had happened. Do you get what I'm saying? Like, it was like all these undeniable experiences that, and then things like this have happened to me a number of times, where I'm not, and I'm certainly not some, you know, I live in a very hippie town where I just moved to North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. It's a really super hippie place where everyone's like, good vibrations and crystals and yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, it drives me crazy. I mean, it's not, I'm not, it's almost like I have a strong knee-jerk reaction to any kind of formal structure on it, as if, oh, if we just use this crystal and do this dance, then, you know, or whatever. Like, it doesn't speak to me at all.
You know, you don't really learn anything if somebody's just explaining something to you. Like, if somebody just tells you what something means or what something is, unless if you really are authentically in the first place interested in or you're immersed in the desire to figure something out. That's why, like, on my webpage, I have a, if you really want to communicate something, oh, this is a quote from Stanley Kubrick, if you really want to communicate something, even if it's just an emotion or an attitude, let alone an idea, the least effective and least enjoyable way is directly. It only goes about half an inch. But if you can get people to the point where they have to think a moment at what you're getting at and then discover it, the thrill of discovery goes right through the heart. Now, my feeling with your story, I've heard you tell it a few times now, and every time I hear it, I think about how open you were and how you were like, not following things just at face value, but what is being communicated beyond, but you were relating to the universe as that. Because these things shouldn't be connected, but you were relating to them as if they were, and in doing so, there was actually a real verification that took place experientially, which there's no substitute for. And you can tell that
there's just no substitute for, but also, now there's a few ways you can go from that. I could associate Sirius as a messenger of the Godhead or some sort of intergalactic brotherhood or any of these things and take it as something very literal, and I could become, you know, I could join the Freemasons or something and say that I worship Sirius. The thing is, for me, it wasn't like when I go out at night, like I actually don't even have time for this, but just to say, like, I'm not going to go into a full detail, but I continually have these weird serious experiences. To me, it's like I don't think the proper thing is to revere it as a god or something, but to see it as a representation of that. It's like, again, it's like saying the shadow of the bird. It's like I appreciate it, and I even give a lot of thought to the fact that it could be, in a sense, its own unique thing. When you talk about different densities or whatever, that, you know, experiences I've had with Sirius or with these different, like, archetype, like, I can only describe as, like, what would seem to be an intelligent, like, archetype, whether it be Osiris or this goddess Hecate, which actually I think, David, I might have been right the first time. I think it might actually be Hecate. I just listened to something the other day, and I think that guy is actually right.
Okay.
But whatever. I give a ton of thought to the fact that just as you might have on the Tree of Life different spheres of energy or all this sort of stuff, that these are, you know, a map can show you different territory, and that there are unique things. You know, I'm in North Carolina. Yes, we're all one, but if David's in California and you're in, would you say, Colorado?
Yeah.
We're on the same continent, but we're not even close to each other. So there are different cities, there are different people, there are all these things. So I give a ton of credit to that, and at the same time try, and this could be my own sort of, I don't know, fear of getting trapped in dogma or something being too literal, but I try to always remember, even when I look up at Sirius at night and I kind of like wink and nod at it, you know, it's like it's still with a half a joke in my mind of like, you know, like, it's not like, hey, God, or like, ooh, bow to Sirius or anything like that. I just sort of look at it and I smile and laugh a little, and I go like, you motherfucker, like, I don't know what's up with this, but awesome. Like, awesome. Yeah. I'm just happy to be experiencing it and searching for these answers and finding other people who are interested in talking about these things, because if otherwise I would feel just like crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
Matt, when do you ever have the experience when watching 2001 that it's like a hysterical, insane comedy? Because I felt that with The Shining, specifically 2001, that Dr. Strangelove Lolita humor it only got more cunning. Hmm. That, like, he got more advanced, and that you could take it as, because like every time I hear Hal, I find it hysterical. Like his whole like thing.
Hey, I'm sorry, I really need to cut you off. You guys, please continue. I can't wait to hear what you guys talk about, but my wife just came in the room and pointed at me. I'm supposed to be at work right now.
Oh, shit.
So, it was great meeting you, Matt.
Great
talking to you. Please, if you guys continue, I'll look forward to hearing it, and I definitely want to have you back. Maybe we'll have you and John together, and we could do something like that.
Cool.
So, yeah, have a great day. Real pleasure here, guys.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Here, I'm recording now. We don't have to do much more, unless if you actually want to. But I should probably get going pretty soon too. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Yeah. I mean, I'll just quickly. So you didn't catch any part of my answer to that, huh?
No. You got dropped.
Yeah. I can definitely see what you're saying. I don't know if I can see myself cracking up, like, as a kid, maybe watching it, because I would used to kind of laugh at everything, but yeah, it's not something that I can recall, but I hear what you're saying, though.
Yeah, because, yeah, I don't know. There's this idea, you know, I repeat this often, but I find it one of the most interesting things in the entire Torah, actually, is when the serpent shows up in the garden, and it introduces him as the most cunning of all the creatures in the garden. And in the very next verse, it has, or maybe this is strike that, reverse it, I don't know, but it says Adam and Eve were naked and not ashamed. And the word for naked is the same word for cunning. And so for something to be exposed is the same for something to be hidden, ultimately. But then as far as our relative experience is concerned, it's different. I mean, we compartmentalize, you know, but if something can't be ultimately hidden, yet it can be relatively hidden. And so 2001 A Space Odyssey is very similar in that way. Something is very exposed. It's in plain sight, but it's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
And so I've continually related it to it in that way. But that the way that it's hidden and the cleverness around it and the way that it's conveyed, I feel can be hilarious. So like I've watched 2001 by myself and literally cracked up, which to an outsider would appear totally insane. And it is insane, but at the same time, I'm relating to it on my own terms, you know, I'm not accepting however it's supposed to be as a given. Like, this is how I'm relating to it. This is how I'm relating to it. Like, I've gone to see The Shining in the theater and as a midnight movie, you know, multiple times, and just the audience is cracking up. I haven't gone to see it without them laughing. And I'm wondering, does that get shown as a midnight movie where people don't laugh? Because it's freaking hilarious. You know,
like what scenes, for example, where they laugh?
All the way through. Just how over the top Jack Nicholson is, even from the get-go in the interview, the way that his smile and his eyes and just the way that he twists and turns, like you can see that he's up to something before he even realizes that he's up to something, or maybe he does, you know. Just the nuances are just very precise.
Speaking of that, Rob Egger just posted some video excerpts over this past month. I think his last one was even, I think, on December 20th, of the theme of Jack Torrance, the abusive father. And he points out, you know, again, many, many classically subtle, hidden in plain sight themes, ideas there. And even just, like, stuff I didn't notice before, like none of the men, including Jack, you never see them wearing a wedding ring. And down in the boiler room, there's actually like pornography, pinned up. And yeah, just a ton of other things that, along these lines that,
Something that, I just came across recently as an extension of, so there's also this whole idea that, various directors are in communication to some degree, and even if they're not communicating, like, they'll communicate through their films with each other.
Right.
And there's a really strong, there's many strong arguments for this occurring. I'd say Terry Gilliam and Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Stanley Kubrick. Yeah, the Coen brothers for sure. And so, like, one really big example is, like, Subliminal Synchrosphere just pointed out something that I was wondering about, which is in the film Poltergeist, which I've analyzed a lot and I love, that it, first of all, I noticed myself that the woman on the mother is seen reading, if you look up close, you know, Carl Jung's Man and His Symbols in bed while her husband reads a Ronald Reagan book. Now, simultaneously, while she's reading, on the television, it's playing a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie, but it's with Spencer Tracy, and the person who he's talking to is actually Stuart Ullman, the actor of Stuart Ullman, in this scene. Now, what's interesting is, like, this is the beginning of the film, towards the beginning of the film, and if you watch The Shining, there's tons, and there's, like, an incredible amount of parallels between The Shining and Poltergeist. You could go on for days.
Who's Stuart Ullman?
Stuart Ullman is the man interviewing Jack to stay in the motel over the winter. Okay. And so that guy who's behind that desk. Now that guy at his desk, he has Carl Jung's The Red Book. So here you have this parallel existing where the guy interviewing Jack is on the screen while she's reading Jung and he's got Jung out. You know, it's just like, That is uncanny. Like that, right. That is a direct sync wink, is what it feels like to me. I mean, the spirits come out of the television set at 2:37. So if you look closely on the television set, you can see 2:37. You know, it's just it's all too much. It's built on a burial ground. You know, they say the Overlook was built on an Indian burial ground. You know, and so I apply it in terms of that we are all on a burial ground. Like our cities are built on cities of old. And on top of dead bodies, you know, it's all blood in the streets, you know.
Just to add to this, I actually live in Simi Valley, and that's where Poltergeist was filmed. And like, I've driven by the Poltergeist house, and that's also where the Ronald Reagan library is.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So. And it's, I mean... Yeah, it's very. I guess the history there. I mean, that there is Indian Indians were there. I guess, and I had a friend of mine who's quite psychic, you might say, and he didn't really know. I didn't talk to him about any of this stuff, but he stayed over, and he sensed a lot of Indian energy. Even and it's not like I have Indian stuff over my apartment there.
Wow.
And it's actually it's on the north hill of Simi. So I sometimes wonder if I'm actually living on that same Indian burial ground.
Well, this was very relatable to your article because this is the thing with Ronald Reagan is he's our first actor president. Mm. You know, and I don't believe he ever stopped acting.
Right.
I believe that was why he was such a great cast. He was a casted character. You know, and so, you know, in the same way that you're watching a film, like, the thing that's awesome about Poltergeist, just like 2001, is that the spirits come out of the television. You're watching television. At the end of the film, they kick out the television. Now, Poltergeist and E.T. are from the same story.
I remember you talking about that, yeah.
Right. And so, if you play the two together, starting at the point at which the studios fade out, there's actually a 3 seconds... or so, or 4 seconds, left of Poltergeist from the point at which E.T. ends. And those seconds are when they kick out the television set.
Okay.
So you could take it that you're literally... you're in the thing, watching the thing, watching yourself, symbolically, at least, because this is a story of you.
Yeah, yeah. I remember, I had a couple of weeks ago, I had a scar on my face. And so I went into the bathroom and I just doused a towel in like witch hazel, and I was just like digging into my cheek, and like all this blood was coming out, and I just there was something in there I had to get out, and I just felt like I was in that Poltergeist scene.
So here, this is a great quote from the Vanity Fair thing that's very applicable here, in my opinion. So when he sent you a book, speaking to Kubrick, he wanted you to read it, and not just read it, but to drop everything and get into it. John Cowley, who was probably Stanley's closest friend, told me that when he was head of production at Warner's in the 70s and first working with him, Stanley sent him a set of Frasier's The Golden Bough, unabridged, and then bugged him every couple of weeks for a year about reading it. Finally, Cowley said, "Stanley, I've got a studio to run. I don't have time to read mythology." "It's not mythology, John," Stanley said. "It's your life."
Mm.
And so I feel like he related to his own films as that because his working on it is his life. And everybody who's involved in working with it, it's their life. So they are literally infused into the thing. And so as you're watching it, you're also, there is no, he's like encouraging this barrier between the audience and the film to collapse so that you can actually, you know, have a true exchange or a true resonance with what it is that you're looking upon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, I was thinking about this like last week about how Kubrick gets into his films so much. Like, to take The Shining as an example, like, I don't know if you've seen, I know Rob Egger focused a couple times on this, where his daughter at the time had her own kind of side documentary and would film things and film Jack Nicholson off camera you know, film the character that was in Lolita coming to visit Kubrick while he's filming The Shining. Does this sound familiar? I don't know if you've seen this.
Oh, yeah. And then I saw Rob Agger pointed out that he didn't have people on the set regularly. He didn't have, like, visitors.
Right.
Extremely rare event. And then is it that it just so happens that he happens to visit on that day as she's filming? Or is it he's trying to communicate something about the relationship in Lolita, relating it to Danny, you know, with the, like, playgirl, why do parents molest their children, appearing right before the interview, you know, like...
Right.
I don't think that that's, like, the examples of these things are worth considering. I don't think it's worth, like, standing up and shouting it that this is what it is, but that's something to consider, you know, like, that's a reasonable assessment of that something's being communicated.
Yeah, and there's an element here that I would speculate that actually moves into magic, one form of magic, in that, because it ties into synchronicities. Like, you take someone like Kubrick, who was so devoted to the films while he was making them, that, you know, it's probably fairly obvious to some that, you know, the filming of the movie did not just, it wasn't just a 9-to-5 thing for him. I mean, this is something that he was completely consumed with. And then, so when you were this, let's just say, polarized, and all the various aspects of yourself are aligned, then synchronicities happen around you, and one might say this is one form of magic. And I think, you know, I would speculate that Kubrick was doing this either knowingly or not, either intentionally or not. I mean, these types of synchronicities. I mean, it may be a part of that, and I think this is part of, you know, the nature of consciousness. And I don't know, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think the fact that he said what he said in relation to the Golden Bough, and how strongly he apparently felt about it to keep calling the guy, that's the basis of the Golden Bough, is that despite, like, anything that, like, that's the basis of a lot of anthropology, or at least, you know, what you can extrapolate, is that if we've practiced these things and not just, like, built this repetition, but if these things are based on actual dynamics that exist, that we will end up playing out the same patterns. And so that our lives are, like, you know, a microcosm of the whole of human history on a certain level, but then the specific archetypes that we're portraying, unconsciously or otherwise, have been the same archetypes that have been played out forever. You know, or at least since we're as far back as we're able to document, you know, and it just, that's like the basis of Alan's Suicide Kings book is the specifics around the king kill ritual, and that we play out this thing. In fact, the Tree of Life has been related to that. Crowley was a huge fan of the Golden Bough, as was Kubrick, obviously, like I just said. And, you know, like that he applied the Tree of Life to what's communicated in the Golden Bough, and saw it as, like, a way to, you bring in, like, if you have inertia, something's moving in a straight line, and it's nothing, it won't ever deviate its course on its own. It needs some outside agent in order to shift things. That's the basis of the Golden Bough, is you have somebody come in to the community, challenge the king, take over the throne if he's able to defeat the king in battle, marry the king's daughter, and so it's a way of not letting a kingdom stagnate by keeping it in the family, you know. And so the idea is, like, if you refuse to do that, if you refuse to let in some outside agent, you're kind of doomed in a way, because you're going to keep playing out, you're going to play out the same cycle anyway, so you might as well bring in some other element in order to let it shift enough that it can actually rejuvenate itself and not just decay. And so you could argue that we're living in a decaying situation as a result of us being so stubborn that we don't want to do that. Does that make sense to you?
I think so.
It's a little complex, but I mean, the Tree of Life itself is meant to be a cycle that's not just it's not a cycle as a circle, it's a cycle as a spiral. And so it shifts and it changes, but it communicates the same repeated dynamics. And because this is occurring on a fundamental level, we can't help but replicate it. and our systems, being a replication of that, will never be that, but we do our best, basically, you know, with what we're dealing with, what we have.
Yeah. There's one kind of tangent when you brought up the idea of inertia, like using the physics analogy, that just reminds me of this concept of like in Einstein's special relativity, when you, this idea of length contraction, and anytime you move, you have a velocity in a certain direction, space actually contracts along in that direction. So when you, it's actually quite literally, when you reach for something, it actually comes back to you. It actually gets closer to you in a very real sense, in terms of special relativity.
Luke hanging upside down and Hoth for his lightsaber.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So, you know, the tree itself is looked at as a example of infinite recursion as well, because any spherot that you go into, you know, it's a whole other set of the spherot or within. And so, and then you go into any one of those. So it's literally a representation of a fractal. So when you read the Zohar, you see a fractal being described, because in every part is contained the whole. And that is literally, I mean, I guess, what our minds tend to do. Like, that is a basis. Like, if you ever look at, like, Wilhelm Reich's The Function of Orgasm, actually our neuroses, our collective neuroses, or I don't know if he phrases it that way, but just the idea that we're all participating in this neurotic behavior, which is literally like a infinite recursion of either trauma or something that hasn't been reconciled. And so we keep repeating the same behavior, but we're also, you know, becoming more like, it's a like a coping mechanism to deal with the hurt or the trauma, you know.
Right. And sometimes we can break these cycles. Like, I can't think of any specific example, but I do have a remembrance of this kind of thing happening, you know, multiple times in my life, where some situation would happen and then, you know, things wouldn't turn out exactly as I would like. And then, you know, next time I could feel it would happen again, things didn't turn out exactly again, but then I would remember, like, my remembering of it would come sooner and sooner and sooner, until finally, when I find myself in that situation, then, you know, maybe, for instance, I might stay quiet rather than react to something. And it's kind of like that repeating cycle then gets solved, and you just kind of, like, you found the way out into peace and harmony or whatnot, and then you kind of, then it stops, and you move on to something else.
Right. No, totally. Yeah. I feel like that was quite possibly like a something that was looked at in public relations, of a way to deal with the public, is just the awareness that this is going on. But the irony that the people who are manipulating the public are susceptible to all the same things that the public is, inevitably is a recipe for some disaster at some point. Because it would be one thing if they weren't subjected to the same neurotic stuff, but then the arrogance to assume that they're somehow above it, and then trying to manipulate people through it,
they fall sick to their own poison, you're saying?
Yeah, I feel like that goes on quite a bit. There's a book, I was mentioning Wilhelm Reich, but he did a book, I think it's called The Psychology of Fascism, where he talks about the Third Reich and how it is that, like, the people's neuroses played in to, you know, what became of that, you know, and how on earth did that happen, you know? And that's really a great read. I highly recommend it. I find it also very applicable in regards to what it is that you're presenting here, because I feel like a big part of this is the psychology. It's not like, you know, a lot of conspiracy ideas that get presented, especially if people are bringing something up into something that's very charged, you know, that people have a relationship to, that's like, very traumatized, you know, they tend to, like, discount how the people themselves are, like, playing into it. Like to really get into the nitty-gritty of the psychology and not just that you're being manipulated into kind of, like, push this us and them kind of mentality, because really there is no us and them. I feel like that's not the ultimate truth, you know, because the people who are pushing the manipulation themselves are part of it, you know, they're playing into something as well. And so we're all, and then we're playing in, if we weren't doing what we were doing in ourselves, these things wouldn't work. I take that as the meaning of, or part of the meaning of defying Hollywood, you know.
Yeah, talking about Germany, I mean, I took a history course once where, I mean, the main idea as far as why did Hitler, or why did Germany, you know, fall to Hitler in that way, it was basically because Germany was, you know, shortly before that, was just kind of getting beat up as a country from all different sides. And so it was just getting, it was kind of like, a kid who's tired of getting bullied. So they just kind of rise up. Mm-hmm. But is there more to it than that, in essence, in the book you're talking about?
Yeah, he goes into more of, well, you know, he's a student of Freud, you know. And so, I mean, he was very close with Freud. But he took a departure in his own direction and kind of emphasized certain points and kind of let other points slip by the wayside. So he's very focused on sexuality. So he'd look at the swastika itself as, you know, the way that the subconscious takes it in is it literally two people having intercourse. And so the SS is them, like, spooning them side by side. And that when we look at the swastika, it's like, and because, you know, it's a conquest, you know, we relate to sex as a conquest, it translates over into politics. And so you can see this represented, and Rob Agard does a wonderful job of communicating it. I mean, anyone should see this anyway if they're paying attention to Full Metal Jacket, is that they're taking their sexuality and then they're applying it to killing.
And absolutely.
And so Born to Kill is like you're born to reproduce. You're born to have intercourse, but instead it's like it takes the place of it. And this is what you'll see in the Zohar when you talk about the Klipo, is that literally what is the substitute for us instead of God? So you can't see God, you can only see his back parts, meaning it's reversed. What is it that you're relating to as God, and how does it translate? And they have it that it's literally, it's death. It's like the death instinct, which is one with the pleasure principle, I guess, is how you'd look at it if you're applying it in terms of psychology. And so that's just fully loaded with implications. And you can see that the way that people are manipulated, because we all don't want to experience pain, we all want to experience pleasure, and none of us wants to die. You know, we want to live forever. That's why we name our children after ourselves, you know, and carry on legacies and do all of this stuff, you know, and build empires, which is an extension of that same thing, you know. Kubrick was a genius, but nothing that I see is there's nothing truly occult. You know, it's all very right out in the open, you know, which is why it's true art, is to be able to hide something in the open like that is just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, every point that you make when you're looking at a reversal, you're like, okay, where does the reversal of the film show up? And then what are its implications? Right. Interestingly enough, every time you see it, apparently the implications are there.
Yeah.
And it's presented within in a reasonable way. So yeah, it's a huge value. I don't know, maybe you want to wrap this up here. Does that feel appropriate for you?
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to mention? I'll get back to playing video games and hanging out with my family here.
are you visiting someone right now, or is someone visiting
you? Our family kind of gets back together. We kind of converge back into Colorado here.
Nice. Yeah, this isn't my regular space either. I'm in a guest bedroom in a house in Seattle where I live. I live close to San Francisco. I live in Santa Cruz, California. So,
Okay, two of my brothers are over here from Seattle.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah. All energy flows according to the whims of the great magnet.
Okay.
So have a wonderful day. Did you want to drop your email or anything? Your website, I guess.
Yeah, I think if you just Google, probably the easiest way to find it is just 2001, A False Flag Odyssey. And then the people will find it. If people really want to type it out, it's 2001.a-false-flag-odyssey.com. So, it's, there you go.
Nice. This has been a very, very enjoyable conversation.
Yeah, likewise. I was looking forward to this for a while, and I enjoy very much listening to you guys. It's about as good as having conversations in my own head, I'd have to say.
Nice. Well, that's a huge compliment. So hopefully we'll have you on again with John at some point in the, not too distant future, if you're down with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care, David.
Bye. Bye. I see a damsel in danger and distress. I see that she is pretty. I see a young girl dressed in a dirty dress. I see that she is pretty. You're my